So thanks for coming tonight. So this is the second talk in a series of three on Cold Mountains poetry. How many of you here were here last week? So maybe about two-thirds, a few not. So just as a kind of a brief introduction to Cold Mountain, he was a hermit, a mountain hermit sage living in China, probably somewhere between the 7th and the 9th century. He was probably a Chinese official, because the Chinese officials back in those days were the ones who were educated. They didn't have like aristocracy like in Europe. They had a different system. So they had the emperor, and then the administration of government wasn't done by the nobility. It was done by an educated kind of class of official. And those officials were hooked in with the particular dynasty, the emperor, either military or hereditary ruler. And the dynasties would change. And when the dynasties would change, because there might be a coup, sometimes the official would be out of favor. Sometimes the official would switch allegiances. And so officials, kind of their lives were a bit precarious at those times of change. And also, since they were educated, they were frequently, quite savvy to what was going on. So a lot of times the government that would get into place in China would be a bit morally corrupt. It would be like overtaxing the civilians and stuff. And when that would happen, a lot of times in the poetry of that time, you'd get political commentary in the poetry. So Cold Mountain was probably an official who took to the mountain to hide. And some of his poems kind of give you the impression that he had a family, might even had a son, but at some point in time, he disappeared to the mountain. And the reason I wanted to share some of his poems was because I think there's a lot of I think two things. I think, first of all, there's a lot of Buddhist teachings in his poems, particularly in Han Shan's poems. And Han Shan, by the way, just means Cold Mountain. So he just took the name of the place he was at. So it's not his given name. It's kind of one he took on. But I think there's a lot of Dharma in his poems. I think there's a lot of just really interesting Dharmic expressions. It's very pithy, one or two lines, which I don't know, for me, just capture something special. And also, because I like Han Shan's poems, I think poetry sometimes points us a bit more directly to what's going on. It jumps a little to the chase. It can be a bit more direct. And poetry's not something I've always been interested in. So I think it's just neat to introduce you to something different, just a different way of kind of approaching the Dharma. And this happens to be one that I do like. So it's kind of a bit of background for what we did last week. The poems, if those of you that weren't here last week, if you'd like a copy of the poems that I passed out last week, I've got a few photocopies left, but you can also download it from the website, but I can give you what I've got here. And we went through poems that, in particular, showed the advantage of reading poems that are done by a Buddhist in translation. Because you're translating, not only when you translate from Chinese are you translating from Chinese to English, but you're also translating in a Buddhist poem. And sometimes the language, the literal Chinese language, might not convey the nuance of what's happening from a Buddhist perspective. So the really kind of stark one I shared last week was Han Shan talking. He's in this conversation with a guy that's come and said, "Oh, look, your life of poverty is just unreasonable." And some academic translators have taken the closing line of that poem for as Han Shan saying that yes, money matters a lot. It's really important. And another translator says, well, actually, the closing line's more along the lines of, well, you stick with your money, your concern for money. I'll go my own way. And they're very different translations of that concluding line, and it gives you a completely different impression of who Han Shan was. And there'll be a couple other poems today where I'll share that sort of that difference of a direct translation of the Chinese, which might be accurate, but you kind of think from a Dharmic perspective, it doesn't quite get it. And therefore, it can be misleading. So we looked at that last week, and we also looked at some of his poems around just being misunderstood himself. He wasn't a very good poet. Well, it seems like he wasn't a very good poet. You know, he was not as skilled technically as many of the people around him. But as he said in his poem, he'd rather write poor poetry than be blind to the sun. You know, and I think he used the line something like, you know, other people's, you know, your poetry, you complain that I'm kind of haven't got the techniques down, but actually you're just a blind man singing about the sun, you know. And I just love that. I think, you know. So today what we're going to do is we're going to look at some of Han Shan's poems which point at his critique of society around him, and also some of his metaphors for what samsara is like. And so I will pass these sheets around. It should be enough. Thanks, David. And so I would ask you to not read too far ahead. I think one of the things about a handout is that you get it and you just kind of read through it and you don't hear anything. Well, you're just kind of listening peripherally to what I say. So please do. I'll try and stay with it. So first of all, I'd like to draw your attention to the front picture. So Han Shan had two sort of friends. I spoke about this last week. He had two friends that he's frequently depicted with. They're always laughing. They're always playing jokes and stuff. And I think that's a really interesting facet of Han Shan as a Zen poet, because as you'll read, his poetry can be very kind of straight to the chase, almost a bit coarse, and it's just kind of the way it just says what he thinks. Like in the poem underneath this, all of you are priceless gems aboard a rotting ship at sea. You know, that doesn't sound very lighthearted, does it? No. But all of his images are lighthearted, and I think there's something about this that's very interesting from a Buddhist perspective, that Buddhism has this a reputation amongst people that don't understand Buddhism, that, you know, Buddhism's talking about suffering, the first noble truth, you know, life is suffering. It's a very uplifting message, isn't it? And I think Buddhism can be very serious. You know, Buddhism, like we just did a retreat with some of us, we're just on a weekend retreat where we looked at the four reflections that turn the mind towards the Dharma. You know, and besides the preciousness of this human opportunity, which everybody likes, yeah, you get death and impermanent, karma and rebirth, and defects of samsara. And, you know, in some ways, it can seem as if it's really sobering and dour and kind of like, oh, yeah, okay, yeah, life sucks sort of message. But it's far from what you experience when you meet Buddhist practitioners. You don't meet kind of like really run down, kind of despondent, kind of dour. I don't know. Maybe you do. Maybe that's what it's like coming to center. But I don't think you meet people like that. I think you meet very well-rounded, happy, healthy human beings usually. You meet people that are laughing. If any of you came to the Bhadrakali's festival, kind of the talent show that Nick helped run. You know, it was very joyous. I mean, they were doing Zumba with like 15 people, it was just really fun. So I think that's an interesting reflection that somehow you can speak seriously and yet still be lighthearted. And it feels as if it's a contradiction, but it's not. It's only a contradiction from where we're at now. But it's not a contradiction from the perspective of awakening, from the perspective of spiritual growth. You know, there will be joy, and you will also kind of be reflecting on death. You know? Because the reflection on death, what it'll do is it'll free you up. It'll free you up. It'll open up the limitations. It'll sort of, because with death, it's not only that good things pass away, but bad things pass away too. Yeah, and it's not only that bad things pass away, but death's also, you know, kind of associated with birth, and birth is of new beginnings. So that whole message of impermanence is both kind of what can happen, what is possible, and that nothing is fixed. Nothing is fixed, and therefore we've got kind of control, we've got agency in that. So I think Han Shan's, the fact that he's really happy is worth thinking about as I read you the rest of these poems. The other thing I thought I'd mention to you is that with Chinese poetry, it's interesting to realize what an effect Chinese poetry has had on, like, say, for example, American poetry, contemporary poetry. So what they thought in the early days was they thought that the Chinese language, that every character kind of corresponded to an image, like it was a pictographic sort of language. So you had an image for the sun, you had an image for the tree. And then what they thought was that the image for east was sort of sun above tree, yeah, in morning, yeah? And they thought that that's kind of like how Chinese language worked, which made it a very rich, dynamic, evocative kind of language. And they thought because of the poetry, they thought in the early days, that was how these poems were being written. So because of that, many American poets, and Ezra Pound, who I think went on to be jailed for Nazism or kind of connected to that or something, I'm not quite sure of the history there, but you know, some of the American poets, they started trying to write their poetry like that. They started trying to use less concept and more just image, and they tried to not tell you what your feeling was going to be, but just try and evoke it by just throwing image out there. So there's actually supposedly two divisions in particular of American poetry. One is, I turned a page, but see, it's an assumption you have that somehow it corresponds to a page you have, but it doesn't. Interesting, isn't it? It's my own page. So in American poetry, there's like linear poetry, and there's ideogrammic, I guess is what they call it, poetry. And when I read this, I just thought, wow, interesting. Is anybody here familiar with Mary Oliver's poems? Yeah. They're beautiful, aren't they? And they're very image-based. They throw images at you, and those images evoke. And so Chinese poetry, and it was a misperception about Chinese poetry, because Chinese language isn't like that. It's not these clean pictograms. Yeah, and it's not like that. It's true to it to some extent, but not completely. So it was actually a misperception on these people's parts, but it actually resulted in a whole revolution in poetry. Isn't that fascinating? So now you can turn the page. So what I'd like to do, and what I've done is, Cold Mountain wrote over 300 poems, and what I did was I read through all those poems, and I grabbed the ones that I thought could speak more easily about Buddhism, and also spoke more easily to me. You know, so I did filter out kind of the poems that moved me. So you might choose different poems if you went through it. For the most part, I've used this book, which is The Collected Songs of Cold Mountain by Red Pine. And Red Pine's a Buddhist, and he speaks Chinese. So I really feel like of all the poems I've read, his are the best. So, and also, I have to say, I've got a lot of respect for anybody that prints the Chinese next to the English. I just think that's just his integrity. Yeah, I really love that. So I would recommend that book. And since I'm kind of printed off a lot of his poems, if you do like the poems, do think about buying his book, you know, to support him in his work. So, the only other thing I'll say is that with the notation, where it says Red Pine 2000-233, that is this book, Red Pine, and there's the citations at the end of here, but it's poem number 233. So here's the first metaphor for samsara. Who can tell me what samsara is? Who wants to give a stab at what samsara is? All right. So what samsara is when in Buddhism we talk about kind of the world that we're embedded in, samsara, which is conditioned existence. It's the world in which things arise on the basis of conditions and fall away on the basis of conditions. Now, in particular, the difference between samsara and nirvana is that in samsara, when we're experiencing samsara, we're actually approaching the world kind of through craving, hatred, and spiritual delusion. So the spiritual delusion is that we have a perception of ourself, and we have a perception of other, and we think that those are fixed. So we actually kind of make solid that distinction between self and other that we're actually cognizing, that we're perceiving. We believe it. It's a bit like an optical illusion, though. There isn't that clean separation, but we believe there is that clean separation. And because we believe there's that clean separation, we start to impute on things kind of existence through time. And it's not so much that they are just there in time, but they are permanent. We think they're permanent. We think that they are consistent and have an inherent existence. And then comes in craving and hatred, because due to kind of a feeling of lack in ourselves, because we're assuming we're seeing ourselves as separate, we sort of try and bring ourselves closer to things that we find around us that bring pleasure, and we try and push away the things that cause us pain. Yeah? And samsara is that constant, that attempt to push away what causes us pain and bring towards us what causes pleasure. But since we're deluded, particularly because we think that we can hold that consistently, that somehow we can kind of grasp reality and fix it, but we can't. So reality is a bit like trying to hold a big kind of bucket of sand in your hand. It just sort of hits your hand and just flows right past it. So that's what reality does to us. It just keeps flowing. Yeah? So samsara is that attempt to try and fix it, hold it, contain it, kind of grab it. And that just causes us suffering. So here's some metaphors of... And the three-spoked wheel, what do you think the wheel refers to in Buddhism? Those of you that know a little Buddhism. The wheel of life. So it's image right here, which is an image of kind of our you know, situation we find ourselves in. You could spend a whole 6 weeks unpacking that image, so I won't spend a lot. But when it talks about the three-spoked wheel in his poetry, he's talking about the three spokes being craving, hatred, and delusion. And it sits at the center of the whole wheel. It's the whole center around which kind of sentient existence revolves. So I'll read a few of his poems. Our lives are circumscribed by dust. We're like bugs inside a bowl, going in circles all day long, never leaving our bowl. Eternal life is beyond our reach. Afflictions never end. The month and years flow by. Suddenly, we're old men or women. So I'll read it again. Our lives are circumscribed by dust. We're like bugs inside a bowl, going in circles all day long, never leaving our bowl. Eternal life is beyond our reach. Afflictions never end. The months and years flow by. Suddenly, we're old women. Did you like that? So, I really love that image of bugs inside a bowl. You just think of like, I don't know if you've ever had a bug get caught in your bathroom sink or something like that, and they just can't get out, can they? You know, and it's just kind of quite sad because they'll just die in there. And every now and then you get ones that just walk around in circles, you know, because they can't quite get enough, but they just kind of keep going around in circles. And I guess he's saying that that's kind of what we do. We just go around in circles. We go around in circles. And the means by which we're kind of approaching life, you know, we're trying to get happiness, but it just doesn't work. It doesn't work. It's not an effective approach. And we're just like bugs in a bowl.
Brendan, what do you think our lives are circumscribed by dust? What do you think you're referring to?
I don't quite know, but I know that the Buddha used dust as a metaphor for kind of samsaric life. So he used to talk about the dusty householder's life. And at that time, you got to remember it was a cling, you know, it was monastic and householders. But I think that, you know, you need to really, you know, I think that dust is just like the dusty life, just the kind of the just doing the same old thing, and I think that's kind of what he's pointing towards. Do you have any ideas?
Well, I didn't know whether I thought, because dust is sort of the insubstantiality of dust. That's what I was initially thinking, but now you say that, yes. Mm. That sort of makes sense. What? Body?
What?
Body?
Body. You have to say more. Matter.
The body.
Yeah, our lives are. Yeah.
Dust to dust.
Dust to dust, yeah. Could be materiality. I think that's one of the beautiful things about poetry is trying, you know, kind of finding our own way in. I think sometimes that's what it can give us. It can let us, can leave us wondering about something a bit. And when we wonder about it, we reflect on it. And that's a very powerful process in Buddhism to come back to something and wonder, what's it mean? What's he saying? Kind of, you know? I think that's really good. And I think that's evoked by poetry in a way that's not evoked by, like, commentary. Mm-hmm. It's a bit like, dust means this, mm-hmm. You know?
It makes me think of dust in your eyes so that you can't see clearly.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. And that's something, as we go through here, we'll pull out other things from Buddhism that you'll start to recognize some of the Buddhist references in his poems, and that's a very famous reference too. What's that from, Erica?
I can't remember.
Okay. Well, when the Buddha gained enlightenment and he was thinking about whether to teach or not, yeah, Brahma Sahapati supposedly came up and said, well, look, you have to teach because there's some people with but little dust in their eyes. So, you know, the idea that your eyes are covered with dust would be sort of like an image of delusion. Yeah. So
dust has, I mean, we could list dozens of things for dust. And the other thing about it is that it's, you can do stuff with it, but it doesn't hold. You know, you walk in it and your footprint is filled in. You make it into a ball and put it down and it just disappears again. So that you can make no progress with dust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So I think these sorts of things are just good to throw around. Let's read another one, kind of like for him talking about kind of the situation we're in. So the one below that. The suffering of the wheel is relentless, back and forth stirring up the dust. The ant patrol on its endless round. The six paths are nothing but confusion. Changing heads and switching faces doesn't free you from yourself. Bring this hell of darkness to an end. Don't let your mind grow dim. So the suffering of the wheel is a reference to the wheel of life. So that's the three-spoked kind of craving, hatred, and delusion. The six paths are the six realms in the wheel of life. So it's an actual direct reference to this symbol. You know? And changing heads and switching faces doesn't free you from yourself. It's sort of, I mean, one kind of thing that's talking about, just, well, I don't, what do you think that might be a reference to?
Rebirth.
Rebirth, yeah. It's an obvious one. And also just that tendency we have to try and change, like do a geographical. Has everybody ever heard of that before? In AA, they talk about doing geographicals. You know, it's sort of like when things aren't working out where you're at, you do a geographical. You just move places and you leave all your trouble behind and you go somewhere else. So changing heads and switching faces doesn't free you from yourself.
Are we talking to about masks and personality?
Yep. Doesn't free you from yourself. And all those external changes doesn't free you from yourself. So, and then there's another one which is to the right of that. When will the treadmill of life and death stop? Each rebirth gets more confusing. Until we discover the jewel of our mind, we're like blind mules following our feet. When will the treadmill of life and death stop? Each rebirth gets more confusing. Until we discover the jewel of our mind, we're like blind mules following our feet. One of the things I really love about his poems is his use of like jewel of the mind. You know, I just sort of think, wow, yeah, cool. I like a jewel of the mind. He's got, on the front one, he's got all of you are priceless gems. I like being a priceless gem. All of you are priceless gems too, I want you to know. It is, isn't it? But I think that sort of, in some ways, the poems, who was it? I forget. Somebody once said something to me about, you know, Buddhism. They're saying, Buddhism's pessimistic. Yeah? And somebody came back and said, no, it's not. It's realistic. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And I do think that, you know, some of these poems, you know, this idea of the relentless wheel and being bugs in a bowl and kind of being blind mules following your feet, that's not very exciting, is it? You know? But that's kind of what can happen if we just keep following craving, hatred, and delusion. You just kind of repeating difficulty. But then there's this other side, which is the laughing Hanshan. This is the Hanshan that's kind of quite lighthearted and easygoing, which is more like he's discovered the jewel of the mind. You know, that's what he's done. He's discovered the jewel of the mind. And he's saying to us all that we've all got that. You know, it's all there. So, I was going to read some poems about, you know, samsara, greed, hatred, delusion, ignorance. I won't read them all, but I'll read a few of them. I'll read the one on the right-hand side, poem 114. It starts with a poor donkey, because I think it's quite difficult to understand this one, actually. A poor donkey is short by a bushel. A rich dog has 3 pints to spare. When poverty isn't equally shared, we separate comfort and hardship. But if we let the donkey fill up, we cause the dog to starve. I've weighed this for you carefully. It just makes me depressed. Anybody have any idea what that might mean? Yep. A poor donkey is short by a bushel. A rich dog has 3 pints to spare. When poverty isn't equally shared, we separate comfort and hardship. But if we let the donkey fill up, we cause the dog to starve. I've weighed this for you carefully. It just makes me depressed. I think so, yeah. I think it's kind of, it's basically kind of, you know, in America we call it Democrats versus Republicans. So the poor donkey short by a bushel probably of just sort of like, you know, like bushel of wheat or something, right? It's very basic agricultural, you know, it's like the donkey doesn't have anything to eat, basically. And the donkey is a sort of a working animal. Whereas the dog has 3 pints to spare. Pints are pints of alcohol. So it's not really food, it's more like drink. So the rich dog, yeah, has 3 pints. So the dog is rich with luxury goods, the donkey's poor with food. Yeah. Poverty isn't equally shared. One's rich, one's poor. Yeah. And we separate comfort and hardship. So in a way, well, either way, okay. So, but if we let the donkey fill up, we cause the dog to starve. And this is kind of the interesting thing. It's sort of like, it's the whole income distribution, income inequality thing back in China in the 7th and 8th century. You know, the rich people have got their riches. They don't want to give it to the poor people because they think the poor people just sort of skive off the system, right? And then it leaves the rich person kind of like without anything because all the masses have kind of consumed all the stuff, and I think that's what's referring to. It's a political commentary on that, and as he says, I've weighed it up for you carefully. It just makes me depressed.
Why did you say that?
I think it's because of the two mindsets of the two. It's like the mindset one is of craving and hoarding, and it's like you want them to be generous, but the mindset of the other is grabbing whatever they can get. So when you've got someone hoarding and you've got someone grabbing whatever they can get, the hoarder won't let go. And if they do, the person grabbing whatever they get will just make them grab hold tighter. So it just ends up in a vicious loop. Either way. I think that's one of his political poems. And quite difficult. But here's a more straightforward one. It's the one on the left. Rich men met in an elegant hall. The colored lanterns glow so bright. Then a man who had no candle thought he would sit nearby. Instead, he was chased away, back to his place in the dark. How could more eyes ruin the light? Strange to begrudge leftover rays. There's a story, supposedly, in China of a kind of like a bunch of women that would sew at night, and they'd all take turns bringing candles, and after a while, one of the women complained that one of the other women was too poor to bring any candles, and the woman that was too poor to bring any candles, she just said, "Well, it's true, I can't bring any candles. I'm too poor, but you know, but me being here doesn't take any light away from anybody. It doesn't make the candles grow dimmer." You know, what's wrong with me being here? And it's just an interesting thing on kind of generosity, isn't it? It's like we even lack generosity. Well, this is the cause of samsara. We can even lack generosity with something that it doesn't it's no skin off our back to share. And we still don't want to. So I'm going to move on. So under complacency, intoxication of youth, health, and vigor, there's a couple poems at the beginning there about kind of young women and young men and just sort of it's just poems about how it is. But I like the poem that's number 306, which starts out, "All the people I see." So I'll read that one. "All the people I see struggle over everything. One day they suddenly die, and all they get is some ground. 4 feet wide, 8 feet long. If you can stop your struggling, I'll carve your name in stone." Isn't that good? So you know, and you think about it, you know, you struggle and you strain, and in the end, you're just this, you know, I mean, like Taranatha, he's this carved rock now. It's Sudarshan Loka, you know? And people, that's a bad example because Taranatha was a great man, so don't get me wrong. But we all end up like that, don't we? We all end up basically just mounds underneath the trees. And in some ways, we do all this struggle to kind of gather things and gain things and stuff. And if you could stop the struggle, it's just like he'll carve you a stone now, you know? It's like you don't have to, it's not like you have to do all that struggling to get that. There's a couple poems then too about trying to win samsara's crooked game of power, riches, and influence. I'll read the one. I want to get on the ones that are a bit more uplifting, actually. So I'll leave those. But you know, they're basically about fools and ministers and kind of building empires and kind of how it comes to naught in the end. But he's got a couple poems on homelessness too. And on the homelessness poems, which is the next page afterwards, the homeless in these things are monks. Okay? So he criticized the lay population, but he also criticized the monastic population at the time. So I'll read both of those, but I'll read the first one on the left first. "The homeless people I know don't practice the homeless profession. You know when people are homeless. Their minds are pure and detached, transparent without any secrets, free and naturally so. The three realms don't affect them. The four births don't restrict them. Without any plans or cares, they wander forever content." And the next one. "I see people chanting sutras, relying on the words of others. Mouths at work without their minds, mouths and minds at odds. The mind, in truth, contains no tangles. It creates no walls or chains. Just examine your own self. Don't look for a stand-in. He who masters his own mouth knows there's no inside or out." So the homeless profession is the monks, you know, professional wanderers, professional homeless people. So what do you think that second poem is saying? "I see people chanting sutras, relying on the words of others. Mouths at work without their minds, mouths and minds at odds. The mind in truth contains no tangles. It creates no walls or chains." What do you think that's criticizing?
Just following rituals without really being...
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
Second chakra, second fetter.
Yep, yep. Fetter of rites and rituals. Very much so. Superficiality. So, you know, Cold Mountain is pointing us to actual practice. So let's read the poem at the very bottom of this page. "Talking about food won't make you full. Talking about clothes won't keep you warm. Only eating food will make you full. Only wearing clothes will keep you warm. People who don't know how to reason just say a Buddha is hard to find. Look inside your mind. There's the Buddha. Don't look around outside." So it's a very similar poem, the last one, just an encouragement to practice, you know? If you wear, talking about clothes won't keep you warm and talking about food won't keep you full. So, you need to practice. He's encouraging us to practice the Dharma. And the Buddha is not something you find outside yourself. It's not something that you find externally. It's something that, arises from within. So when he's talking about Buddha here, is he saying that kind of you're gonna have a Buddha? I mean, what's he talking about? Buddha as what? It's not the historical Buddha, is it?
Concept of Buddha, the liberation, awakening.
Yeah.
In your own life.
Yep. So it's that image of awakening. So right above that, there's a poem. Daily concerns are endless. The addiction to life never stops. Grinding away the rock of the earth, nobody gets a break. Seasons wither and change. Festivals suddenly pass. Answer the owner of the burning house. Ride the white ox outside. Now, Erica will know what this is referring to. Rowan might too. Marie will. Robert might. Some of the people I don't recognize might. But what is the answer? Answer the owner of the burning house. That's actually... Yeah?
Well, the burning house is sort of like this samsara.
Yep.
And the owner is kind of like, it's the Buddha.
Well, where's that metaphor, where's that parable come from?
The parable of the burning house in the White Lotus Sutra.
Yeah. And what's the father in the burning, in that parable, that the children are stuck in the house, and the father... tempts them. With what?
Cats.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. So this is a reference to that, answering that call to leave the burning house, to leave the house of samsara. Yeah? Ride the white ox outside. He's mixing now because riding the white ox, have you ever seen those ox herding stories? Images in Zen? So the ox is actually taming the mind in Zen. So you're answering the owner of the burning house and you're riding your own mind out of the house. Yeah? So it'd be really hard to get that if you didn't kind of know, wouldn't it? So let's go on the last page. It's what?
Was there a bit in Watson translation of that one? And what was it like? Because I imagine it would be quite different.
Okay. Well, I don't have Burton Watson's translation of that one down there, yeah. I don't know. It would have been interesting, wouldn't it? Yeah. But this next one actually is a Burton Watson translation next to it. And I think this kind of makes the point of sort of the difference between a translation done by someone who understands Buddhism and someone that's just translating the language. So on the left, Cold Cliff's remoteness is what I like. No one travels this way. A great peak penetrates the clouds. A lone gibbon howls on the ridge. What could please me more? My heart content, I enjoy old age. The seasons change my appearance, but the pearl of my mind stays safe. Really beautiful. But if you read Burton Watson's translation, Cold Cliff, more beautiful the deeper you enter, yet no one travels this road. White clouds idle about the tall crags. On the green peak, a single monkey wails. What other companions do I need? I grow old doing as I please. Though face and form alter with the years, I hold fast to the pearl of the mind. Now, on the surface, they might not seem that different, but I think it's a lot of difference between my heart content, I enjoy old age, and I grow old doing as I please. You know? So, and also, the seasons change my appearance, but the pearl of my mind stays safe, which sort of implies that even though there's all this change going on, there's something that actually is outside of time. This pearl of the mind that's outside of time. Whereas what Burton Watson's saying is, though face and form alter with the years, I hold fast to the pearl of my mind. It's like a quite a clinging sort of like, no, don't take it from me. You know? So, what?
This is all I've got left, yes.
No! That's Mr. Bill, isn't it? So I think that's the difference where you've got a Buddhist translating it, because, yeah, the contentment in old age, too. I mean, that's what I strive for. I grow old doing as I please isn't really what I aspire to. But my heart content, I enjoy old age. I mean, I can get into that. Yeah, it's different, isn't it? The next poem, too. All my life too lazy to work, favoring the light to the heavy. Others take up a career, I hold on to a sutra, a scroll with nothing inside. I open wherever I go. For every illness it has a cure, it heals with whatever works. Once your mind contains no plan, wherever you are, it's alert. And then Burton Watson, all my life I've been lazy, hating anything solemn, finding light matters more congenial. Others may study how to make a profit. I have my single roll of scripture. I don't bother to fit it with roller or case, or trouble to carry it here and there. Like a doctor prescribing a medicine for each disease, I use whatever remedy is at hand to save the world. Only when the mind is free of care can the light of understanding shine in every corner. So, in particular, those last two lines, once your mind contains no plan, is very different from only when the mind is free of care. It's a bit like the kind of doing as I please. It's really this kind of vagabond image of someone kind of that's carefree. But once your mind contains no plan is a much solider Buddhist kind of interpretation of it. So
different, aren't they? It's like a whole different.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you didn't, and honestly, to tell you the truth, I think Burton Watson's translations are pretty good compared to some of the academic ones. You know? So if you didn't know better, you'd pick up, you know, a translation of Han Shan's poems and it might not move you that much. But if you pick up Red Pine's poems, you just sort of, you know, there's something else in there. He gets it. Yeah? So I'm gonna leave you with the last one, and then maybe we'll look at the one on the front again. We looked at it a bit last week, but maybe we'll look at it again. Because I think that even though I think that even though Gold Mountain was very scathing of samsara and people chasing after wealth and riches and holding on to youth and kind of misusing kind of their health and vitality, I think he's just really, you know, he wants to also present what's possible. So this last one, the great sea has no limit. Fish and dragons by the billion. Everyone eating someone else. Busy, stupid lumps of flesh. Because the mind never stops, delusions rise like mist. The moon of our nature is clear and bright. In the open, it shines without limit. So even though his vision of things is that we're just fishes and dragons by the billion, everyone eating someone else, busy, stupid lumps of flesh. That's us. Busy, stupid lumps of flesh. You know, and delusions rise like mist. But, you know, on the positive side, the moon of our nature is clear and bright. In the open, it shines without limit. So when we're not bound by samsara, when we can free ourselves of craving, hatred, and delusion, you know, actually there's a shining, a boundless illumination, a moon of our nature which is clear and bright. So that's some of his poems. So I kind of like to bring you back, leaving with the one on the front, because and maybe draw the different stuff out of this. All of you are priceless gems aboard a rotting ship at sea. In front, the mast is gone. In back, there is no rudder. Heading, wherever the wind may blow, moving with the waves, how will you reach shore? Don't just sit there stiff. So the don't sit there stiff is a reference to just doing meditation stiffly. So it's a reference to not practicing. What do you think the references to the winds might be and the shore? What?
The worldly winds.
Yeah. Yeah. And what are the worldly winds from the Buddhist teaching? Yep, fame and infamy.
Praise and blame.
Praise and blame.
Gain and loss.
Gain and loss. Pleasure and pain. So you know, when we're on this ship, which is us, yeah, we are the rotting ship at sea. So we are a ship that's falling apart. Is anybody getting old enough to recognize that? Yeah? Okay. So we're aboard this rotting ship at sea. Yeah? The mast is gone, and in the back there is no rudder. So we've lost all our steering capacity. And heading wherever the wind may blow is a reference to the eight worldly winds. Just, you know, praise and blame. They blow us around, don't they? We try and avoid blame. We really like praise. If someone praises us, we're quite happy about that. We try and kind of get gains and avoid losses and stuff. And then we're just moving with the waves. How will you reach shore? So there's a, you know, shore with the boat is definitely, you know, like safety, reaching shore. But also shore is an allusion in Buddhism to what? What's the other shore? Enlightenment. So there's a double play here. There's both kind of the fact that the boat is kind of like, you know, gets off the sea, but also shore in Buddhism is used for enlightenment. And then don't just sit there stiff. It's like an urge to really practice, you know, to look inside yourself for awakening. You know, not try and find it outside yourself. It is inside yourself. You know, don't adopt the homeless profession. You know, don't just think that because you kind of wear beads and you meditate and you don't eat meat that somehow you're going to gain enlightenment. Because it doesn't work that way, does it? You know? So you're actually trying to practice. And if you do all this, you know, he's reminding us that we're priceless gems. I love that. All of you are priceless gems. You know, there's so much potential in human beings for, you could say, spiritual greatness. And we fall short of it. It's just like, you know, there's so much potential for kindness and generosity, and we know what effect that has on a group. When you've got a group of people where the interaction is flavored by care and appreciation and gratitude and generosity, something else happens, doesn't it? Something magical happens. It's just really amazing. So that potential exists anytime two people get together. You know, anytime a group of people get together, there is that potential for that. And I guess it'd be nice if we all could realize that. But that's why we're here, because we want to. And that's good. So those are some poems for you. I think, you know, yeah, take them home, read them over, see if they move you. If they don't, that's okay. You'll probably find other poems that are more interesting, or maybe poetry will never be your thing. And that's okay. There's probably at least 10 people that didn't come tonight for that reason. So, any comments?
Very succinct.
I think my only comment is that he always says things like, you are priceless gems. And when he's talking about the more negative stuff, I guess, it's we're like or we will like. So it's not...
Ah, good. I think you're right, actually. I think he's all, you know, it's there's more of a directness and immediacy when he's using those.
And so that's your true nature.
Yeah.
And then, how we behave is just running around like,
Yeah. I think you're right. That's quite good. Thank you.
You could also read the rotten ship at sea, and those who are just sitting there stiff, not bothering to try to reach the other shore. Of course, along with the metaphor of the shore as enlightenment, there is a metaphor of the raft as the means to enlightenment, or practice even. And it could be a sort of subtle reference to people who cling to their practice, their Buddhist practice, in a very safe, conventional, mechanical, unquestioning way, thinking it will solve everything for them, like a magical talisman or whatever, and that's also subject to conditionality, subject to decay, and you have to keep renewing spiritual practice in general. And the fact that he's gone forth from possibly, well, court life, as you say, but it could also be in relation to other monastic communities, to live by himself in a mountain with rather eccentric companions, as opposed to the usual monks, makes it seem as if even conventional monastic life is subject to critique.
It also
contains, because Sangharachita describes sort of his criticism of historical Buddhism, that it goes through all these phases of inspiration, and then you have sort of crystallization, fixing into systems, and then you have decay, and things start to fall into very conventional, superficial practice.
I think that's a really good interpretation of that poem, too. I think you could read that. It makes perfectly good sense. Yeah.
So don't just sit there stiff and easy. These people are meditating, is it?
Well, at that time, there was kind of a lot of people who just sort of meditated, and that they were trying to meditate their way to enlightenment. And he's got a few poems that sort of are alluding to the futility of that.
Grab an oar and row.
In a way. Kind of do something, you know? Do something.
Speaks to getting creative.
Yeah.
To originality.
Yeah.
Got in a few of those poems too.
Yeah.
I don't know, when I see the image of the boat, I think that if you had a boat with no masts and no rudders, you wouldn't actually want to be heading towards the shore. you just wouldn't, because you would be in more danger than further out at sea unless you had a plan.
Oh, right.
Because
you'd be hitting the reef and stuff.
Yeah.
And the rocks.
So, and you can't just sit there and wait for it to happen. You have to do something, otherwise it's going to be a disaster. When I read that, and you were saying the other thing, I said, I wouldn't be heading for shore.
Well, I'm reminded about the book by P.D. James, Children of Men. Read that? I think it's in that one of the old people just put in a rotting hulk and pushed out to sea.
Well, we'll leave that to P.D. James.
suggests a letting go for me. Actually, it doesn't suggest having to do something.
Right.
Just that actually just the letting go at that point.
Yep.
There's no, you're sort of not necessarily, you can't control all these forces.
Acceptance, you know.
Acceptance, yeah.
You're in a rocket ship, that's it.
Yeah. There's other poems he's... I can't remember whether I've pulled them in for next week, because next week I'm going to do some poems which are more about his awakened experience, more from the perspective of awakening. So I kind of picked poems that were a bit autobiographical and descriptive, and then this is kind of samsara, and the last set of poems is a bit more of the awakening poems. But yeah, he does encourage us to, you know, he definitely doesn't encourage you to kind of go around samsara and clean up everything and be a good Buddhist and practice ethics and all that. He's definitely kind of a much more magical and mysterious than that. All right. Well, thanks everyone for coming. We'll have a meditation after about maybe a 15-minute tea break.